in the deep end, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to learn some stuff. I'm going to see some things that a little fella from Murrurundi may have never seen before. So I started hitchhiking around Australia. I literally quit my job, left my girlfriend after that day and said, you know what, I'm hitchhiking around Australia. Walked down the main street of Scone, another great place, and started travelling. And then my journey eventually took me to Tasmania, which was probably about 2 months after I started, by which point my meagre savings had totally evaporated, and I was sleeping on the outskirts of town in a swag and just subsisting on rice cooked in a billy. And I think I was bemoaning the fact to someone about how hard my life was, you know, with no money and no food and no shelter. And they said, why don't you join the woofing organisation? I was like, woofing organisation? Ooh, sounds interesting, go on. And if you're not familiar with it, it's stands for Willing Workers on Organic Farms, and it's an international volunteer organisation. And the premise is, as a volunteer, you do 4 hours work in exchange for food and accommodation, which as a hungry 21-year-old, I thought, I'm going to eat these guys out of house and home. I'm going to do like between like 10 and 2, have a bit of a sleep in, eat some breakfast, wake up, do 4 hours work, eat, knock off at 2, eat. So I joined up. And you get a little book. Is anyone here a member, a host? Have they woofed? I'm also an ambassador. I just made that up. I'm not an ambassador for woofing, but I should be. I can't recommend it highly enough. It is the best way to travel because you're not a voyeur. You are living with people who are genuine members of community. So the cultural exchange and experience is phenomenal. So anyway, I joined up and it costs $50 for a year. And it's just to cover you in case you lose an eyeball while on someone's farm. That was the number one thing that apparently was insured for. You get I think I got $5,000 if I lost an eyeball. So that was, as a poor person at the time, it actually did cross my mind. What is an eyeball worth to me? A patch could be pretty cool. Depth perception, I'm probably overrated. So anyway, I joined up and I'm finally getting to the point. Finally.
In your own time.
And so I had a flick through, excuse me, the local area, and I found a farm that sounded right up my alley. It was an old, I didn't know he was old at the time, but his name was Gilles, and he had a farm, and he was looking for woofers, so I called him up, and he picked me up, and we arrived at his farm at like 8 o'clock at night, and it was in a place literally called Paradise. It's on a map. It's just outside Sheffield. You can see it. It's right in the foothills of Mount Roland there, very beautiful part of the country. And he said, look, Paul, but I'm not going to do a French accent just in case there's any French people here who I will insult. He said, look, you look a bit rough, mate. So go to bed. Here's a cup of tea. Go to bed. I'll get you in the morning. And then we'll start then. So you just have a shower and take it easy tonight. And so next morning, 5 a.m., just to clarify. So far, my woofing dream isn't going exactly according to plan. Paul, I told you I wouldn't do the accent, but I couldn't help it after the end. time to get up. So it was April, and it was, you know, pre-dawn, and he said, you know, on the way up to the house, collect some fruit from the orchard and we'll poach it and juice it for breakfast and come up and eat and then we'll get into the working day.
Woofing, worst idea ever. 5 o'clock in the morning.
So anyway, I go out into this, I was in a little sleep out and I go out and it's this, you know, magnificent scene of, you know, pre-dawn mist, all the trees, the kind of silhouettes of varying distance just disappearing into and out of the mist. And he had this wonderful pome fruit orchard, which at that time of year was, of course, laden with fruit. So I made a little, a little bundle with my jumper like this, a little basket, and I started picking some apples and pears off it, you know, and they're covered in dew and they're cold and crispy. And I realised at that point that as a 21-year-old person, I had never picked fruit off a tree ever in my life, which I kind of got a little bit depressed about for about half a second until I realized I was actually picking fruit right then, and it was most likely going to be delicious. So I took a bite of the, you know, I took a bite of the apple, very biblical. Temptation got the better of me. And, you know, words can't describe. It was just probably the singular most amazing thing I've ever eaten in my life to this day. And I've eaten mutton birds, so... You wouldn't be laughing if you'd eaten mutton birds. And it wasn't really until I wrote the book and had to really look at what brought me to here in retrospect until I realised how much of a pivotal moment that was. I certainly had no understanding of the gravity of it at that moment. I was like, oh, that's nice, up to the house. And when I stayed with this guy for a month, and I come to learn that he kind of was the personification of Old MacDonald. It was one of those little storybook farms of like 20 acres, and he had chickens and cows and pigs and goats and geese and orchards and veggie gardens, and all the work that we did basically revolved around growing food for himself and his family, and by extension me. And he'd grown up in the south of France in Provence, and he was in his 60s at this stage, and basically he was trying to recreate that small farm market culture that he'd grown up with in the south of France, and doing a bloody good job of it. All his neighbours constantly came around to barter and swap and share meals and drink wine. And as a 21-year-old person with no degree, no trade, no real direction, at that age you're quite open to inspiration. And when I stayed with Gilles, I felt like I'd found the magic bullet for the meaning of life. I was like, oh my God, it's hiding here in paradise in Tasmania. People have quested for centuries to find the meaning of life, and here he is, right here, like working in a way that you can see tangible results for every day, and that aren't just tangible results, they're deliciously tangible results. You know, all the work that we did, every meal that we cooked three times a day had some component from that farm, or was traded off with a neighbour. And I'd never witnessed such a connected way of life. I grew up, like I said, in the Hunter Valley, where farmers were angry old, you know, men in their 70s with rusty Land Cruisers. That was, and even angrier dogs. That to me is what a farmer was, a beef grazier, you know, that didn't want, you know, because I grew up in the shop, and we had lots of farmers come in, and they were, you know, they just grunted at me as a child, hardly the stuff to kind of go, that's what I want to do, that's the connectivity I want. But then to go and experience what Gilles offered, and it was one of those things where you just go, that's it. That's the secret. That's the key. That's what I want to do. I want to do this. I want to grow food, and I want to enjoy my family, and I want to be a part of a community, and I want to be in bloody good health and drink lots of wine.
So that passion for food then took you to the kitchen of Vieux du Monde?
In a very roundabout way. Yeah it did.
But the reality,
which is
wasn't...
kind of like the antithesis of that. The realisation that I had in Tasmania was that I want to do this, but then the reality of it was that I've got none of the skills. Can't cook, can't grow. So I continued woofing for a while and did a lot of work in community gardens for another 2 years to get a handle on growing. And then I felt like I was, you know, could plant things and grow them and have harvests. So I was pretty confident with that. Still could not cook to save myself. And doing community garden work and permaculture work, a lot of which is volunteer, doesn't pay very well. So I took up a job as a chef's apprentice, working for one of my mates in Newcastle. And after about a year and a half, I decided I wanted to make a proper go of this. If I'm going to do my apprenticeship, I want to do it in the best possible restaurant I can get admitted to. I didn't want to work in Sydney, so this is pre-internet, everything being available on the internet. I actually called The Age and said, can you guys send me a copy of the Age Good Food Guide? Because we only get the Sydney Morning Herald Good Food Guide here in New South Wales. And they did. They obliged. Very nice. Very friendly. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to start at the top and work my way back. Best restaurant in Melbourne at the time was Vieux du Monde, Three Hats. And so I started with them, and I sent them an email and said, guys, you know, oh, I'm sure you get, you know, wannabe apprentices. You get thousands of emails like this a day, but please, please, I'm different. Can I please have the opportunity to come and at least just do a trial in your beautiful vaunted halls? And what I didn't realise at the time, of course, was restaurants like that are always looking for fresh flesh for the fire. And so they got this email, they're like, yes, oh, of course, come down for a trial, yes. And so they got back rather promptly and said, yeah, we'd love you to come down for an opportunity. So I flew down on my days off from my job in Newcastle, did my first ever 16-hour day, which was great. Was not really expecting that. And had gone from kind of working on a, you know, as if it was like a nice cafe in Monaco, somewhere like that, kind of like a breakfast, lunch, dinner, 7 day a week kind of place on a nice little dining strip, quite friendly, you know, a couple of busy services a week, and then went down to this, and this is like the first time I'd ever even stepped foot in like a serious restaurant. Like we don't do breakfasts. This is 100% top of its game fine dining. And, you know, going from a crew of about four chefs and a couple of dishes, you know, all of whom were pretty casual, to walking into a restaurant on Tuesday morning, which for fine dining restaurants is the busiest day because they're shut Sunday, Monday usually. So Tuesday, you're basically prepping the whole menu from scratch. 30 chefs, head down. Nothing's like, it's just silence and pans and just a general tension in the air. And automatically, I could just stress like this. And they took me upstairs to get changed for the trial. And I remember standing there and going, nah, nah, I should just sneak out the back door now and get out while the getting's good. But stupid me, got changed, went down, and 2 years later I got spat out the other side. And when you work in a place like that, because there's 90-hour weeks every week without fail, fully booked breakfast, lunch and dinner services, the real kind of rock and roll of the culinary world, but decidedly lacking in glamour. You know, we kind of glorify those restaurants, but to be a line cook in one of them is like working three factory jobs at the same time, with zero protection and zero wage protection, no industry power. It's really just a culture of abuse. And as a result of that, the people who do it and stick at it, that you kind of get this like sadistic, club of people where you're like, if you can't handle it, then just beat it. There's the door. If you don't want to be here, there's plenty of other people that do. And so you kind of get sucked up into this macho boys club of like, yeah, 16-hour days. Yeah, another one. Yeah, I haven't seen sunlight for a month. Yeah, this is great. Yeah, I'm getting paid $2 now. Woo! There's a lot of glory to it on the surface. You know, there's Dom Perignon and there's models and actresses and actors and politicians and stuff dining there, and you're dealing with the best produce on the planet. But I remember after being there for about a year and a half, I'm a bit slow on the uptake, I went, I don't think this is for me. Because it was at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because that job, you run solely on adrenaline. It sounds like a little bit cliched maybe, but I'd imagine there's some serious scientific proof there, if there was to be a study, because, it's so intense. And so there's always a lull at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You're still in the kitchen, but you've just finished lunch service and you're starting to get ready for dinner service, which starts at 5:30. And so at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, all your adrenaline's kaput and you're starting to feel the fact that you sleep 3 hours a night and work for 90 hours a week, and you kind of go into this like weird psychedelic state, which I could somewhat recommend, but it's quite hard to get to. There's probably cheaper means to get to that spirit animal state than by working in a fine dining restaurant. And just remember being there one day and thinking back to that farm with Gilles and going, this is the absolute antithesis of why I started to cook. I'd cook probably about 250 meals a day, every day. I wouldn't see one person that I cooked for. I wouldn't sit down to enjoy a meal myself. I didn't eat at all. I wasn't outside. I didn't have any family or friends around me. The only people I saw were this kind of like band of, you know, of kind of masterless samurai that, you know, were just had questionable people abilities, but hearts of gold. So I had to leave from there on in, you know, because I kind of finally saw through that culture that I'd been washed up in or caught up in, and it's just so far removed from everything that food can be, which is this amazing tool for connecting us to the environment and to our communities and to our families and to ourselves. It's really one of the most holistic things that we can engage in. And when you're working at one of the best restaurants in the country, like, there's a lot of attention about the food that's coming out of these places, and you think that that's the epicenter of it. But the irony for me was that it was totally removed from food as I understood it.
We're going to find out what happened next.
Oh,
after
yes.
Entree,
stay tuned.
Because we're averaging approximately 8 minutes a question at the moment. And I can see the catering staff waiting anxiously out in the wings. So
should I let everyone know
Paul,
what we're having?
Yes, please.
So we're having a rabbit rillette with some lovely crusty white bread. So slow cooked and flaked with fat and served with mustard and maybe cornichons, I'm not sure. Anyway, mustard and crusty bread in the rillette. If there wasn't some cornichons, then next time try it with cornichons. And as well as a pea and broad bean tart, of course, because we're in winter, we're in the time of the legume, but that's a lovely sweet meal. So
we'll see you after.
Enjoy.
Again. All right, over to you.
Order in the library. This is a library, you know, you lot. And not just any, it's the National Library, so you should be extra quiet.
Well, they got your attention.
Who gave me a microphone? Terrible idea.
So, I'm being a country girl. I know that usually you have to be somewhere 20 years before you're actually considered a local. So how did the residents of Tilburg react to this production company lobbing into town and this celebrity chef deciding he was going to live there?
They threw a ticker tape parade for me. It was great. We had a float down the main street and I waved at everyone. Give massive lie. So I arrived at the farm about 3 weeks before we started shooting, and everyone kind of knew that it was happening because, you know, the producers had been in and doing stuff, but I was the only person actually living there at the time. So we started kind of 3 weeks out, but I stayed on the farm, and then everyone else kind of ferried back and forth to Sydney, so I had a lot of time by myself there. My partner was still in Tassie, so I go up to the pub, and they're obviously, that's the epicentre of Tilburg society, the Dromedary Hotel, great pub, if you've never been there. I get free schooners if I talk about the Dromedary everywhere I go. So I'd be in there, you know, because I was, you know, I'd sit up at the farm by myself or go to the pub and talk to the locals, and they'd be like, you know, what's going on with that TV production? And I was contractually bound to not tell anyone that I was the host. So I told them that I was the camera assistant and the farm manager, And I was just there getting ready, and apparently the host was a real knob. and I hadn't met him yet, but I heard on good authority that he was a massive knob. And so they kind of, you know, accepted me quite early without the pretension of understanding. And here's the host. They kind of just got to know me on a little bit more personal level before it kind of came out, and they're like, you liar, you dirty rotten liar, oh, we love you, Westie. So Tilbury, I think, was probably the perfect place to have the show be shot for many reasons, and the one that's most relevant to this conversation is how accepting they are of people from out of town, because Tilbury is one of those parts of the world that is very beautiful and therefore very desirable to live in and to visit. And generally, when a community has a higher turnover of people tree changing or sea changing, as well as the tourist tsunami that happens every summer, they tend to be a little bit more accommodating and accepting of you know, travellers coming to that community. Whereas, you know, where I grew up, and after our conversation at dinner, where you grew up, in a little bit more inland, slightly less glamorous locations, it was, you know, like you really had to be one of the old families to, you know, to even drop the L word. I'm not talking about love. I'm talking about local. And one of the old families would be very happy to correct you should you mention the L word inappropriately. I don't call myself a local still. I live there, but just kind of out of respect for some of the older heads that live there. I've seen Darcy correct some of our staff about some, because we've had the girl who runs the cooking school and is our food researcher has been there for a year and a half now, and she went with some students after to the pub, and they were like, are you a local here? And she's like, yeah. And Darcy, if you've seen the show, no, you're not. So I've never put him to that test. But, you know, because I wouldn't want Darcy to go, nah, to me. I don't know if there's any radio producers in the room, but if you need a late night radio host, Darcy is your man. But by and by, the Tilbury community has been... I've been so lucky, and I think it's because when I think about it, that Tilbury, even though it's a town of a population of 200, but it's quite a strange town, because it's not just like a isolated little town out in the middle of nowhere with 200 people. It's a really popular tourist village. Has everyone here seen Tilbury or been to Tilbury? Yeah, of course. Yeah. Canberra is the only place in Australia where you can get the majority of nods from a room when you talk about somewhere on the south coast. Because no one in Sydney goes, they go, well, north, oh, Byron, where there's a south coast? There's a world past Wollongong? Oh, never in here. But let's keep it that way. Just keep it for us, Canberra and south coast residents. They can keep Byron Bay. Compared to Bermagui, it's a shithole. Can I swear in the National Library?
As long as you do it with correct pronunciation, it'll be fine.
Theses. Theses. Schroeder. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, I've completely forgotten what I was going to ask you now. That's what I was going to... Okay. How close to real life is what we see on the screen? Because I've just told you that you broke our editorial coordinator's heart when she found out that you're actually not a bachelor living with his dog.
Yeah. Just giving each other baby oil rub downs and... another hard day of toil on the land. You look tense, digger. Now my turn. So I think that it's a narrative. So it's not a reality TV show, even though there are more elements to reality in it than any reality TV show, which is probably the most poorly used instance of reality on the face of the planet, a reality TV show. But so I don't live on the farm. I'm sorry. I'm not really, but I'm sorry. So I lived there for the first season when I was living out of a backpack, and I had a boarding room at the back of the house. But that would be the only private space that I had, because the house is a set. The kitchen, your private kitchen area is a set. The lounge room is a set. And so the only little bit of private little Paul dome that I had was a bedroom. And because it was the only, it's a relatively small house compared to, you know, we make it look big on TV, but that's a bit of editorial magic. But it got to use as a storage room. There'd be lights and stuff in there. We film for 10 to 12 hours a day. And it's quite, you need a little bit of solace. I don't know what it's like for someone that is a host on a show that has multiple hosts, but when you present a TV show and you're the only host, I don't know if you've ever had to be on for 12 hours. It's taxing. Trust me. And so, you know, at the end of the day, in the first season I was still living there, I'd be like frazzled from having to be like this all day. And then just want to like sit there and like pat my dog and stare into the distance and go, what's happening? And you know, the other stuff would be like, let's have a drink. We've, you know, been sitting down looking at a computer. Let's go, let's hang around. And I'm like, leave. Leave. What's that? Not leave. Just coming out from underneath the door in my bedroom with four bolts. Leave. So then usually I'd be like, oh, I'm just going to take the dog for a walk and walk up onto one of the higher ridges on the farm and sit there and watch every car leave. Okay, Digger, let's go. They're gone. But I live, I'm there, I'm at the farm every day still. I don't live there, but I'm still there every day. Except actually up until probably 3 months ago, where now I'm there 5 days a week instead of every day. But the first 3 years I was there every single day. And I look after all those animals, and I am a member of that community, because otherwise none of it would work.
Because it's not your typical celeb gig, is it? You don't really just kind of clock off.
No, I think I remember the funniest thing. I don't know what a typical celeb gig looks like, but I'm very grateful that mine looks like Tilba, because I don't know that I'd be up for that kind of like Sydney glamour world. I think too much facial hair, too much body hair, and probably too much central girth to be a legitimate celebrity. But you know, there's nothing but a plastic holiday to plastic surgery holiday to Thailand can't fix. I don't know if anyone's seen Pete Evans' early cookbooks, but he certainly doesn't look like the paleo cure. But anyway, that's another story. I don't, the chef claws are out.
So it's a hard
it has
work?
To be grounded in reality. Yeah.
Is it hard work?
It's hard work, yeah. I think working in that kind of fine dining background held me in really good stead for being doing what I do now, because there's an incredible amount of individual pressure to perform. You kind of can't stuff it up. There's not really, we don't really have a huge margin for error on the show, because filming a show remotely from Sydney is a very expensive enterprise. We don't factor in any room for burning things or just not cooking them right. It's a lot of hard work, and much, much, much harder than I ever anticipated. Because, you know, having been a chef and getting like a TV gig, I was like, oh, hey, crack the bubbles. Break out the banana lounges. I'm having cocktails every day now. I'm going to be on TV. I'll be like a home and away actor. This will be great. I'll do like one day's work a year, and the rest of the time I'll spend at a yoga retreat in Bali. But grateful that that's not the way it is. It's intense. Yeah, that's a lot of, we do a lot of work for a very small amount of screen time. So a season is 8 by 48 minutes, because we don't film ads. And that takes us 4 months. One episode, or roughly 50 minutes of footage, takes us 60 hours. So that's a pretty crappy conversion rate. So it makes for a scintillating bloopers reel. Because they've got a lot of source material from which to put together that blooper reel. I had no idea about any of that until I was kind of thrust into the deep end of it. But I was very fortunate that the people that they hired to make the show were long-standing industry experts who are held in the highest regard, And they kind of took me under their wing and taught or created what they would like to think is the perfect host. I don't know that. Sorry, that didn't come out right. I mean, what like a production crew thinks a host should be, which, having met other TV hosts, is very much different to what a host thinks a host should be. So it's been a bit of a baptism of fire, but it's fun. It still is fun.
Is this where you ever imagined yourself?
No. Actually, I had this last year, my school that I went to asked me back to be their... They're like their fate ambassador. They have a big fate every year and they invite him back. They're like, Paul, come on back. Come on back, alumni. We'd love you to open the school fate and to be the guest auctioneer at our charity antique auction. This is all very nice. And I actually managed to dig out an old school uniform to wear to this like charity gig, which they thought was hilarious. They said I wore it better than I ever did at school. And then the current principal who actually used to be he was the PE teacher when I was still at school, and he didn't brief me on this at all, but he got up to introduce me and he said, we remember Paul when he was here in year 12, and we remember having a staff meeting about he and some of his friends and saying he'll either end up in jail or on TV. And we're very glad that it's the latter. Over to you, Paul. So, no, I didn't really envisage being where I am. I certainly had no media aspirations. I wasn't, you know, shooting a YouTube series or doing any of that stuff to try and get on TV. It was just one of those things that fate had in store. I'm glad it happened, though.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be doing this otherwise.
Well, I'm going to ask you please to introduce dessert that people are enjoying.
Then ladies and gentlemen, dessert. No, just kidding. Now, we've got a lovely hazelnut tort, and we've also got an apple and rhubarb crisp. So, very nice winter fare. I hope you enjoy. I know I'm going to. And then sorry.
Yeah, just don't forget who's running this show here.
Sorry.
we will be back.